It is the right one.
Okay.
Mike and I used to call Hank Bud, we used to call him old Mumbly Pegs, because he looked like Rumpelstiltskins, and he had long legs and kind of whitish hair.
Uh-huh.
But he was certainly into his Bible translation or developing the language. He would he'd be going to the market in town, and he'd see some Minongara that he knew from Lac Dien, and he'd start out and say, well, how do you pronounce the A or the in your language? And he wouldn't even say hello. He just start right into his spiel. And the motor yard captain who lived on the other side of our house, his family, they had a bear, one of these small black honey bears or whatever it is that was a pet. And I remember one day the bear got loose and got on his rope. And he was running around, and so of course he would go through the captain's house and around the kitchen in the back, and then through our part of the house, and around and around and around, chasing after the bear. Anyway. There were three at the time that I lived in Bunlea. There were still three people in the village owned three elephants. Maybe there were even more.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember sometimes they would come into the village. First time I saw them. I wondered why the baby elephant was, kept nuzzling its mother, and then learned that, in fact, it was nursing from the mother because the mammary glands are underneath the front legs.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I wouldn't have thought that. That's a strange one. Drop Molly's little windows here.
I'm kind of running out of steam at the moment.
I know you are, and I wanted to...
Are there any other particular things?
Yeah.
There are all kinds of tales one could tell.
Going
to mountain yard ceremonies. One time I took Jerry Hickey, the anthropologist, up to Futian district in Chiarao to visit the King of Fire, Ptah Pui. The Jirai always had a King of Fire and a King of Water, which Jerry had at least traced from at least the 1500s or before.
Okay.
The Cambodian imperial annals.
Uh-huh.
Where the Cambodians kings would come up to the highlands of Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
To try to establish their suzerainty over the inhabitants, and they would exchange something with the King of Fire or the King of Water. And the King of Fire's, what he would do is give the Cambodian royal representative or whatever a basket full of sesame seeds,
mm-hmm.
which was symbolic of the how numerous the Montagnards were.
Okay.
The Montagnards had various origin myths. The Rade believed they came from Bangladren, which is the it's a hole down near Lac Dien. The Jirai came from what the name of it was. It was a mountain. And on that mountain is the sacred sword. The Jirai have only seven family names.
Uh-huh.
Rechum, Ro, Kapat, Ramah, Ralan, Siu, Kusol. The Rade have more than that. The Montagnards, there were 30 or more different tribes, about a million people in the highlands of Vietnam. Half of them were Malayo-Polynesian, the language groupings.
Mm-hmm.
The Rade and the Jirai that I spent most of my time with are in the Malayo-Polynesian group, as are the Chams. Where I started in Guangdong, the Minong, are in the Mon Khmer language group.
So, more tonal?
No. No, Nino
Matong. Oh, no, of course not. Right.
The Mons are an ethnic group that were somewhere in Thailand, between Thailand and Burma.
Mm-hmm.
So the Montagnards, of course, depending on your view of the ethnology and so on, certainly, there was a migration either from southern China or from the South Sea Islands, but more likely the South Sea Islands, and then went through the Philippines and the archipelago, and eventually up into that the Cordillera in Vietnam, and that's where the Mon Yards were, which was, of course, thousands of years before any Vietnamese ever arrived.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, the Vietnamese are relatively recent.
So, you know, they just couldn't understand why they... Oh, and we would watch time. I mean, and Jerry Hickey said, I mean, what you're watching is the destruction of a society, and he was absolutely right.
Oh,
I mean,
sure.
I didn't believe it, but it was so true to watch the Vietnamese take the Mon Yards land constantly.
Yeah.
Mon Yards practiced Swinton agriculture, rotational, which on a 20-year rotation...
Is okay.
No problem. I mean, the most environmentally sound way of managing that land area. The Vietnamese would come into the area and they would say, and I saw this often around Bambi Tuat, gee, gotta have some place to, need some land. You're not using this field, you know, could I borrow it? The term that the Mon Yards always say, you know, he borrowed it. Well, the Mon Yard would say, yeah, fine, I'm not using it, you can go ahead and borrow it.
Mm-hmm.
Very trusting. Well, the reason the Mon Yard wasn't using it was fallow.
Yeah, it was supposed to be.
The Vietnamese would plant rice on it the first year.
Uh-huh.
The second year, they would put banana plants on it.
Uh-huh.
The third year, put coffee plants on it. Then the Vietnamese would say, oh, permanent crops. It's my field.
Yeah.
And the legal system, of course, was all Vietnamese.
Yeah.
So... And of course, they wanted to, you know, demark things and have, you know, legal papers and registry, that kind of thing. Well, that's not the way the Mon Yards had done it. So they never won in any kind of a court contest. I mean, they were always, they were just losing their land. Round Chararel, one of the villages that I went to, remember the... Along the Mon Yards, the village would be...
Maybe it's the chair.
Mon Yards, their village would not be by the road. Vietnamese, of course, there are settlement patterns. You have a Vietnamese with house and gardens and fields and fence and so on. And, you know, it's and then another one. And so the village is a, you know, major, large area.
Uh-huh.
The Mon Yards, it was a settlement of houses all together. Okay.
Yeah.
And with some sort of a fence around, usually to protect from the tigers.
Uh-huh.
But the fields were out around.
Yeah.
Well, so the Mon Yards in the village here, and there's some distance, you know, between there and the road.
Yeah.
And oftentimes, even when they did a field, there would be a fence and a long, fairly wide. Border strip between mm-hmm. their field and the road. Vietnamese would come along and they would put a house on that border strip. First year. Okay. And then the second year, what you see is they put their house right up against the fence. Then the next year, they make a piggery.
And they cut it off.
They go on the other side of the fence.
Mm-hmm. So this is a complete cut.
So that the piggery is then in what is the field.
Mm-hmm.
And then they say, well, I got my livestock there, and so therefore it's my field. But they don't do that the first year. The first year they put their house on the border strip, which is between the field and the road. And the second year, you know, they break the fence and put their pigsty in the field, and then they start putting in some manioc or something else, and, you know, and you just annex it.
Yeah, I've seen... Other things, because I worked with minority tribes in the Philippines, and well, I'll pause it for this because I'm talking and it's really your take.
Did you ever look at the honey?
Yeah, it's back on again.
Oh, traditional tribal customs and practices and so on. There was one copy of the, there was a tribal law court that used to hold forth in Bon Mituit. The French had written down the mm-hmm. Vade... customary law
mm-hmm.
into a book. There was only one or two of those books around when I was there. Mike Benj got a hold of one and had somebody translate it. I have a whole set of that in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
They say the reason that there was only one was when the Japanese came. They burned the books.
Oh.
But there was some sort of a library there that had, you know, a lot of And so this book had been buried. Mm-hmm. It's the only way that it survived. But it's very interesting. I mean, it has all of the kind of a lot of the sayings, and then what the retribution will be. I mean, if you steal,
oh, really?
A pig,
okay.
Or if you steal something.
It's amazing that they had written it down. I mean, in any form, because I know that.
Well, the French did.
Oh, the French did. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Now, listening to traditional ceremonies and so on, or traditional court proceedings, and they.
Of course, they change over time. They're not static. And so when a colonizer comes in and codifies, they codify at the moment, you know, preventing cultural change in the future.
But, you know, it's interesting that whatever the crime is, it's not a punishment, but it's like an atonement. In other words, if you have stolen a pig, or if you have killed someone, you have to make a payment,
mm-hmm.
of a certain number of animals or a certain number of jugs of wine, or maybe a
kind of like a blood.
And when that's done, it's over. It's finished.
Yeah.
Now in Chirai and Narade, anyway, the biggest ceremony was the funeral ceremony,
mm-hmm.
The Huat Passat. During the dry season, you go from, you know, kind of village to village for, they would hold off on having the funeral ceremony until the dry season, because then it became kind of a social event. You would go from village to village, and one funeral ceremony after another. The biggest ceremonies were the ones that were held for the, when they, abandonment of the grave. The Huat Lui Passat. To leave the grave. So
mm-hmm.
the one I went to that was the most elaborate was 13 years after someone had died. But it depends on the stature of the individual. If it was somebody who was not very prominent, then maybe it's a year or two after they die.
Mm-hmm.
They made very elaborate carvings over the graves. And you see some of them, you know, look like French soldiers, some of them have helicopters, they have, they're totems. Very well done. They were very good weavers, very good trackers. And after they have the ceremony for the abandonment of the grave, then it's over. That's finished.
Yeah.
And the
they're gone.
Spirit,
truly
the soul,
gone.
In the afterlife, and everything is, I mean, that's ended.
Mm-hmm.
I remember a fellow, Ed Sprague, that was a refugee advisor of Fubon province when I was there. He had retired as a sergeant major in special forces previously and had served in the same province. I was in IBS then, and I remember he said he would rather have a company of Montagnards than a company of American soldiers anytime, and I asked him why, and he gave me two examples. He said, when you have an ambush or whatever, somebody starts firing at you, the instinctive reaction that Americans have is they fall down, they drop for cover.
Yeah.
And he said, the Montagnards, the first thing they do is start to fire. And he said, when you're in an ambush, in that instant, when the Americans are dropping, when the Montagnards start to return fire, you know, it can make quite a difference in, you know, the effectiveness of the unit that you have. And he said their sense of direction is another reason. That I said, well, but don't you, in the military, don't you have, you know, walkie-talkies and other kind of communications gear? He said you can get a line of, a march, you know, a mile long, people from one end to the other, and going through jungle and so on. He said the Montagnards, you know, after, you know, a number of hours or whatever, they're still in a straight line. And the Americans are all over the place. And I said, can't you communicate? He said, yeah, you can communicate, but unless, you know, they're right close to the guy next to him. And
they can see him.
Real close. They don't have that sense,
mm-hmm.
of distance and time and so on. So they'll, you know, one end of the line, of course, can't see the other end of the line, and they get, you know, but it's the moment yards will be right on.
Mm.
And then he gave an example of when he was in another province, and at night, you know, they were to return back to their base. And got a compass reading, and he said it's in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
He marched all night and appeared at their camp the next morning. That they, you know, they didn't need any more direction. He said, also, when you get them up in the airplane to be paratroops, that the Americans would get to the door and they would hesitate in the morning. I'd just jump. They really didn't have any fear. They didn't fear death. It was just something that happened. It was a part of the normal cycle, and they were not afraid. Anyway, just an observation.
No, it's a good one. I'd like to thank you for taking this, not the whole afternoon, but because I got here about 2:30 or so, but the time, and for telling me about your IVS experience, both on the tape and our little chatting elsewhere, and good leads to follow up on, and that's it.